This is the second Louise Bourgeois lecture. Today, looking at both the Instruction à ma fille, so the other text, text that I've given out a copy of today, or I should say Tuesday in the lecture. So if you've not picked up a copy of that, there are some available outside my door, H426. Okay, so we'll be looking, as it says on the lecture plan, so that's slide two on the PowerPoint slides, looking at the Instruction. It's a text that's a more professional text that will take us through Louise Bourgeois' perspective on the ethics and values of midwifery, best practice in the delivery room, the behaviour of mothers and their relationship with the midwife and her kind of position in society, if you like, with respect to families, and more widely with respect to the medical world, the male medical establishment. All of those things we're going to come on to look at. But in the first part of the lecture, I just want to take you through other vernacular writing available in French in the period that we're looking at. So just getting a sense of the context for writing in this period, and just to really give you a flavour of what other writers are saying, in order that you can situate Louise Bourgeois' opinions about best practice, bad practice, and so on, that you'll see articulated in the Instruction à ma fille. Okay? Slide three, just reminding you really from last week of the different works that Louise Bourgeois penned, and that, you know, we have this Récit véritable and Instruction that are our texts, but we need to remind ourselves that there is this huge availability, if you like, in her works of different quasi-scientific observations of case studies, essentially. So different experiences she's had, both in the delivery of children and in obstetrical care before delivery, so on and so forth. Okay, so that is also very much a characteristic of her work. Moving on to slide four, early modern obstetric texts in French then, just to draw your attention to Valerie Wirth's work. The slides that follow will give you a series of extracts in French taken from this Droz text, Les Traités d'Obstétrique en langue française au seuil de la modernité. So a work that takes the prefaces of these works and just examines content there, letters, prefaces, and so on, and therefore kind of showing us what writers writing in the vernacular in this period, and, you know, the reasons they had for writing, what was driving them to write, and so on. So it's a very useful text for us, and on the back of that, in the last year, Valerie Wirth has created the Birthing Tales website, which has some English translations of those texts as well. So do look at that if you've not had a chance to do so yet. Okay, first of all then, I want to take you through Renaissance interests in writing in French about obstetrics. Okay, now an interest in obstetrics was widespread in France in our period, and there were many publications, an unusually high number when we compare with other European countries, both in Latin and in French. Latin works were intended for doctors, those who'd been educated to university level. Works written in French were often also written by doctors for various reasons, as we shall see, and some were also written by surgeons. The desire was that these works should alleviate suffering in women and improve practice. Okay, we're going to think about reasons for writing in French now. Why produce these texts in French alongside, if you like, those that existed in Latin? Well, first of all, it was recognised that there was a curiosity about obstetrics, an interest in it. It was also felt that such works in French could act as a remedy for ignorance. There was anxiety about the lack of knowledge of many sages-femmes. Okay, many midwives were rather ignorant. It was felt that they needed to be educated, and also that the women who used them needed to be educated. And in fact, Louise Bourgeois also articulates these beliefs in the Instruction, as you'll go on to see. It was also felt that works written in French might act as a remedy for problems of pudeur. Many women were afraid to consult doctors and surgeons about a part of the body that they considered to be shameful. So there was an anxiety about going to the male medical establishment with such problems. Manuals, therefore, it was felt, would help women identify problems themselves and perhaps act to remedy them. It was also felt that works produced in French would bring about improvements in practice for the male medical world, that it would provide, or they would provide, greater information for surgeons who may not read Latin. And finally, such works were written, some of them at least, within a tradition of works that really wanted to celebrate the natural world and knowledge and discovery of that world. So there are certain of these works that are really kind of celebrating this as a kind of fundamental feature of the human condition, if you like. However, there were those who raised anxieties about the very availability of such texts in French. And I just want to now take you through some of the reasons for that. It was felt that the unique authority of the male medical establishment might be compromised by such texts. It's also feared that such texts may inform lay people about how to practice abortion. And perhaps in association with that, that these texts might constitute a moral threat for lay people by discussing parts of the body that were considered traditionally to be shameful. There were also more technical questions. Questions about translating terminology into French, terms, for instance, that have been translated or inherited rather from ancient texts. How should these be translated into the vernacular? And there is another tricky question about what one should include in such texts. For instance, on the subject of obstetrics, there were folk remedies and women's secrets, women's secrets that have been passed down orally from generation to generation. Should these be included in such texts, or might this be crediting these kind of ideas with too much significance? However, of course, we need to remember that in this period, it was very largely women who had the hands-on experience of delivering children, and therefore perhaps their knowledge needed to be incorporated. So these were questions that were being raised by some. Let's look now at what was available to readers who could read French in this period, okay? Worth saying then that when we get to the mid-16th, 17th century, there were a number of vernacular works, and that some had been previously available for some time. And the prime example of this is the Trotula, which you've got on slide 5. You can see this is a 12th century Latin text, widely disseminated in France, and translated into French by the Middle Ages, actually. Now, this was a text that was a kind of general text. It was a manual about women's illnesses in general, and it was for the use of doctors, barber surgeons, midwives, and ordinary women. Okay. When we move on to look at slide 6, we come on to the first work that was really to popularise medical knowledge about childbirth in particular. Okay, and that is Roslin's A Manual for Midwives, written originally in German, as you can see, a Latin version produced in 1532, that was largely used by the male medical establishment, but then we see a French version produced, 1536, and it was a popular work, 6 French editions up to the beginning of the 17th century. Okay, and you'll see what I've done here is to just give you a little extract from each of these manuals that I'm drawing your attention to. So on the right-hand side of the page here, you can see Roslin just stressing the importance of informing midwives about best practice. Il me semblerait trop nécessaire que les gardes d'accoucher et celles qu'on l'on appelle sage-femme ou matrone sucent ces secrets sur le doigt pour survenir à telles incommodités que plus souvent sont cause de grands dangers. So in other words, women who are practicing in this field should have this kind of knowledge at the tip of their fingers, on their fingertips, in order to be able to act accordingly in the delivery space. So very pro the transmission of knowledge in the vernacular. When we move on to slide 7, we see an extract here from a work by Ambroise Paré. Now, if you remember, we mentioned Paré in the first lecture. He was a surgeon, a very reputable surgeon, who acted as surgeon to 4 kings of France. And it was for him that Louise Bourgeois' husband worked. Okay. Now he produces an obstetric treatise, De la manière d'extraire les enfants, 1549, firstly in the Brief Collection de l'administration anatomique, and then again in the Anatomie universelle. Okay. Worth noting about Paré that he wasn't a member of the Faculty of Medicine, and therefore wasn't thoroughly integrated into male elite medical circles. So he is very pro sharing knowledge and producing medical texts in the vernacular for the benefit of surgeons as well as women. And you have this articulated in the quote that I've given you. So if you look on the right-hand side at the first bullet point, we have Barré saying this: J'ai appris les 10 documents de Galien par l'interprétation Françoise de Monsieur Maître Jean Canapé. So what he's saying is that, you know, what he's learned about has come from Galen. And the reason he's been able to learn from Galen is because of a French translation produced by Jean Canapé. Okay. Now, Galen, an ancient writer on this topic. So he's very favourable to the fact that such a text has been produced and is available to him. And in fact, he says that in the second half of the paragraph. Je proteste que nous sommes tous à lui grandement obligés pour ce que nous a traduit en français plusieurs livres exquis et nécessaires à la consommation de notre art. Okay? So, transmission of knowledge in the vernacular, a good thing for Barré. The other thing that he places emphasis on is his hands-on experience, and that's what you have at the second bullet point. Je n'ai entrepris d'écrire ce traité, sinon après avoir par espace de longtemps mis la main à l'œuvre, tant à la maison de l'Hôtel Dieu à Paris qu'au Guerre et autres lieux. So I have hands-on experience, says Barré, and he mentions the Hôtel Dieu, which was a hospital for the delivery of children to poor women and to women who were thought to be disreputable. So those who'd conceived outside marriage, for example. So he's had hands-on experience in this kind of establishment, which may well set him apart from those doctors operating in elite medical circles. Okay. Moving on to slide 8 then, we see Guillaume Chrestien, a doctor, in fact, who produces a translation of Hippocrates, another ancient writer, De la nature de l'enfant au ventre de la mère. So this is a work that was destined for male practitioners. And also, says Chrestien, femmes vertueuses. So he would like women, virtuous women, to have access to this text. But primarily, one sense is that he's writing for the male medical establishment, because within this text, there are references to other ancient medical texts. Okay. Now, just to take you through the quote on the right, then, what Chrestien places emphasis on here is the usefulness of this text, because it guards against the female fear of revealing intimate questions to the male medical establishment. Okay, so it's empowering women, it's equipping them with knowledge where they may have been fearful of acquiring knowledge before. So, vous prenez volontiers grand plaisir à entendre tels secrets qui ne sont communément connus à tous pour charitablement en aider et faire secours aux femmes tant pusillanimes et craintives qu'il leur semblerait avoir engagé leur honneur ou offensé leur pudicité, si elles découvraient leur grief passion aux médecins doctes et bien expérimentés. So that second half then, this fear that if they revealed particular problems to médecins doctes, so those illustrious doctors who were part of the male medical establishment, embarrassment might prevent them from revealing such information, and this text will help counter that. Moving on to slide 9, we have Jean Liebeau, Trois livres appartenant aux infirmités et maladies des femmes. Okay, so just a text that explores female ailments, if you like. But what's interesting here, I think, is just a picture of understanding about anatomy within the domain of obstetrics in this period, and how we can see real differences here. And what we have here are some theories about menstruation and then about breast milk. Okay. Il faut confesser que la femme par-dessus l'homme a reçu un excellent privilège de nature. Okay, so here he's celebrating the female body. Okay, so we're in the line of those kind of celebratory texts. Vous voyez que nature nourrit dans la matrice l'enfant de son menstrual. Mais c'est une merveille qu'aussitôt qu'il est sorti en lumière, le sang rebrousse en haut par les mammilières et se jette dans les cavités de la mamelle où il se convertit en lait. So what Liebeau is saying here is that it's a truly marvelous thing that the child in the womb is nourished by menstrual blood, but that once the child is born, Okay, once he is sorti en lumière, the blood rises into the breasts and comes out as breast milk. Okay, so a kind of picture of red menstrual blood moving on, transforming itself into a kind of white menstrual substance. Okay, so very different picture of anatomy from any kind of modern understanding that we have, but worth just noting that that was a widespread understanding at the time. Okay, I just let you have a look at that. Finally, I have an extract from Jacques Guillaumeau's De l'heureuse accouchement des femmes, okay? A popular work in this period, and also De la Reniture et gouvernement des enfants, also very popular, okay? Worth stressing, I think, or what I wanted to stress in the extract that I've given you, is another kind of anatomical association that we might find surprising from our modern perspective. Okay, what Guillaumeau is saying at this point in his text is that one really has to be cautious about finding a wet nurse for one's child, because somehow moral qualities can be transmitted through breast milk. Okay, and many high-ranking women wouldn't feed the child themselves. They would employ a wet nurse, and often these wet nurses were taken from the Hotel Dieu, where they'd just delivered themselves. So they were women that weren't necessarily terribly reputable. Let's just see what Guillaumeau has to say here. Pour le regard des mœurs, il n'y a aucune comparaison pour la nourriture de la nourrice avec celle de la propre mère. So he seems to be pro-breastfeeding here. You know, the mother's milk is best. Il faut croire que l'enfant, en tétant le lait de la nourrice, qui sera vicieuse, suce aussi les vices et malices, dit-elle. Car encore que l'enfant soit né d'un bon père et bonne mère, si est-ce que la mauvaise nourriture d'une méchante nourrice le fera vicieux et méchant. So what he's saying here is, if you have a wet nurse that is not morally upright, then however much the child might be born of good parents, he could well be corrupted by the milk of the wet nurse. So again, this is a prevalent opinion at the time, and you'll see this articulated in the instruction, which I'll mention it a little bit later. Okay. Now, Charles Guillaumeau augments his father's work, and also is involved in a polemical discussion with Louise Bourgeois about a particular case, one that I mentioned last week, where she was accused of malpractice. Okay. And I've just got a little extract from Charles Guillaumeau's writing, 1641 to 43 edition there. What's interesting about this, I think, particularly at the end of the text, is that Guillaumeau is very suspicious of female practitioners, and indeed those who aren't really members of the male elite medical establishment, being able to use books usefully. So he has a rather different take on the availability of texts. Okay. He says, last five or six line, je réponds que ni elle, okay, so neither women, however capable they may be, ni les chirurgiens, ne se doivent par si fort fier au livre, ni à celui-ci même, car il le peut avenir souvent de se tromper et de manquer en cela, non par la faute du livre, mais par leur propre ignorance, pour n'être pas bien instruit dans les principes de la médecine, okay? So, even this book might not be terribly helpful to those who haven't been well educated in the practice of medicine. It's possible to get things wrong by relying on a book. And this is interesting because, you know, it's the other side of the argument, if you like, from some of those we've seen articulated earlier. Okay, finally, perhaps worth saying, or Valerie Worth certainly makes the point, that within all these treaties, if you read them all, you'd see that there were no real major step forwards in the practice of obstetrics in this period that we're looking at. There was a tendency for practitioners to look back to their medieval forebears and to ancient writers. One exception to this was Paré, who advocates a particular treatment for breech births called pedalic version, which does take the skills on somewhat. Okay, so that's just a little bit of background for you. And that's the end of the slides, in fact. What I wanted to do now is just to take you through points to look out for in the Instruction à ma fille, and just to give you a little bit of background information to that text. Okay. Worth saying that there is a very good article written on this text by Colette Twin, and I've put it on your seminar sheet, so you could look at that if you want some further guidance on reading. Now, the text was written for Louise Bourgeois' youngest daughter, and it's of interest for two particular reasons. It gives account of the birth experience from the point of view of the mother and of the midwife. So here we have Louise Bourgeois writing as a midwife, but also as a mother who wants to help her daughter get on in life, if you like. And so it's interesting for those two reasons. It tells us something of, it tells us some very clear points about how Louise Bourgeois understands her profession, but there are also some kind of emotional dimensions to it in the way in which she approaches the duty of motherhood, if you like. And in fact, Colette Wynne tells us the text does stand out by the very fact that it exists at all. Generally, surviving manuals that treated the behaviour of women were written by men. There was a tradition of literate women writing texts instructing their daughters on how to live. And of course, women were generally held to have particular responsibilities for bringing up daughters correctly. But not many of these documents survive. When we look at the content of the instruction, it's even more surprising because it doesn't counsel the daughter to behave in the usual deferential and inconspicuous manner that was the norm for conduct books in the period. Okay. And we'll see this again coming up in Madame de Sévigné's letters to her daughter. It was felt generally that women should be instructed in the values that patriarchal society thought was appropriate to them. Louise Bourgeois's text does this to some extent. It teaches the daughter fear of God and humility, but there is a major emphasis in this text on the potential professional life of the daughter. And we're told that the daughter has shown a desire to be a midwife and that this calling or vocation needs to be tested. Okay, so it is very much seen as a calling, a vocation, not just a job. And we're told that, in fact, the daughter starts gaining experience in this area very young, and that she's assisted at over 50 deliveries before the age of 15. So she's concerned in this text to show her daughters the obligations, pleasures and trials of midwifery as a career, and to ensure that she understands the moral values of the profession. In other words, Louise Bourgeois is speaking as one professional woman to another potential one. Her words suggest that she prizes values such as job satisfaction and personal fulfilment, individual values that were rarely held to be the prerogative of women at this period. Louise Bourgeois's status, economic status as a bourgeois woman, in fact, partly accounts for this. She isn't writing as a noblewoman to her daughter. She's writing knowing that her daughter will need to work. But this text does, as I say, stand out because it's a training document, and therefore it's the kind of thing that hitherto would only have been passed on orally between women. So let's have a look at what Louise Bourgeois tells her daughter before thinking a little bit more about the radical nature of the text we have. So I'm going to look a little bit now, if you want to scroll up to the lecture plan, I'm looking here, slide two, at the ethics and value of midwifery. Now, Louise Bourgeois uses a rather attractive extended metaphor to describe her craft on page 184. She says that a midwife can be compared to un grand pilote maître conducteur of the vaisseau de grande importance, which is the mother's body or womb. Okay? So the womb is like a vessel, and the midwife finds herself in a position of great responsibility, one that requires courage and skill. Just as a poor sailor might cause a shipwreck, so a precious vessel, such as that containing a child, should be safely guided into port by an appropriate person. She says that the midwife has moral responsibilities. And in fact, we know that women of ill repute couldn't become midwives. You had to have your moral rectitude certified by the curate of the parish. So these moral responsibilities include not practicing abortion, page 176. This is the foremost of these principles. We're also told on 176 that the midwife should not deal with immoral women and certainly not allow them to give birth in her house. They might want to give birth in her house because they have nowhere to go and they want to hide the birth. She tells her daughter that it is her Christian duty to uphold morality, but also to act with charity and counsel these women, perhaps find them a place to go. And they could be sent to the Hôtel Dieu, of course, the institution that I previously mentioned. But, she warns, care must be taken that the midwife maintain her reputation for respectability. Okay, and one of the handouts that I gave out, entitled The Appendice, give you a series of statutes that the women, that midwives were held to have to adhere to in this period. And we'll talk a little bit about those in the seminar, but it's worth having a look at those. And just mentioning that there were guilds of midwifery growing, developing in major urban centres such as Paris in this period. So the beginnings of an effort to regulate the profession of midwifery in some places. Okay. She instructs her daughter then that she should act with charity by serving the poor graciously and not accepting money from them, on page 177. She shows clearly that the midwife views herself as a servant of the people in the manner of a priest. Here we see evidence of Louise Bourgeois' capacity for compassion. She recognises that poor women do not have the luxury of a lying-in period before and after birth, and therefore must be taken exceptionally good care of. The text begins and ends with a reminder that the practice of midwifery is a divine, quasi-priestly calling. It can't be forced on any person, page 175. The midwife, then, should act with a confidence that can only be bestowed by God, page 192 to 193. Okay, so one of the things the text does, as point two on that second slide shows, is to indicate what Louise Bourgeois believes to be best practice in the delivery room. And this is something that I'm going to get you to look at in preparation for the seminar. So I won't dwell on that terribly much, except to say that the relationship between the midwife and her client is indeed an interesting one. And somebody's actually preparing a review of an article by Wendy Perkins, The Relationship Between Midwife and Client, 1989, just exploring the nature of that relationship. So we'll pick that up in the seminar, but do look at the summary available on the forum. Okay. And this then, this question of best practice in the delivery room, leads Louise Bourgeois on to look at the behaviour of mothers and those around them. So what we see here is that the instruction is in part a moralising text. It's as much about teaching the daughter and other readers how to read human nature as it is about teaching the practical arts of midwifery. Every mother is different, says Louise Bourgeois, and their needs and habits in the social context of their time need to be understood if the midwife, providing a service industry, is to establish herself successfully as a practitioner. So we're told clearly mothers are frightened in labour, and this is entirely natural. They need reassurance. They need the comprehension of their midwife. So look out for Louise Bourgeois' examples of problems that arise when the midwife doesn't take control or when the mother doesn't want her to take control. The midwife should expect to be in a position of power, but to have to use that power appropriately and sometimes very tactfully. Okay, she has a responsibility, but she is a client of the mother. Labouring mothers dealt with by Louise Bourgeois clearly came from all ranks, from what she says. However, Wendy Perkins points out in her article, page 78, that Louise Bourgeois seemed particularly to deal with damoiselles, so women who were likely to be members of the upper bourgeoisie, and dames, so women of noble status or women married to an officer. Okay, so she's working very often with a fairly high-ranking clientele. It's interesting to observe Louise Bourgeois' reflections on society. She believes that society's roles, morals are deteriorating. That young women, demoiselles, are too flighty, page 181, and that they're not chaperoned enough by older women, family members. She says that young women gossip too much, and that this is a new social trend. When they visit their pregnant friends, they don't encourage them, but tell them awful stories. Hitherto, says Louise Bourgeois, women visited pregnant friends and family out of true affection for them. Now they only do it pour la forme, page 182, i.e. because it's the social thing to do. So Louise Bourgeois seems to be suggesting here that this kind of socialising around pregnancy isn't necessarily done with the prime welfare of the mother in mind. So perhaps, you know, one of the questions you might want to ask yourselves is whether she seems to think that solidarity amongst women around childbirth is beginning to dissipate or fragment somehow. Does she ask herself any questions about why this should be? As I mentioned in relation to Guillaume, Louise Bourgeois also is anxious about dubious breast milk, about women acting as wet nurses who are disreputable. She talks about this breast milk as being les amoureux, and that it does indeed corrupt the child who drinks from the breast of the corrupt mother, of the corrupt wet nurse rather. So find a good quality wet nurse is her advice. She also, you know, again, looking at maternal responsibilities, she affirms that mothers carry a large measure of responsibility for the health of the child they're carrying. So acts such as horse riding or dancing, as well as more serious accidents, might cause the child to be stillborn, 188, and the mother and the midwife must take care not to be blamed for these or other accidents when the mother doesn't want to admit culpability. So the midwife's in a precarious position then. There's a lot invested in her to bring to birth a healthy child. And of course, when one thinks of the principal role of married women in this period, it was indeed to produce healthy heirs, healthy offspring. What Louise Bourgeois is saying is that some of that responsibility must also fall on the mother's shoulder. And in fact, that anxiety that married women would have of their, you know, around their duty to produce an heir, if you like, lies, or gives rise to, I should say, another danger that Louise Bourgeois draws attention to, and that is the tendency in some women for them to fake pregnancy, page 188. Elle feigne parfois d'être grosse pour être mieux voulue de le mari ou la donner espérance d'en avoir, so to have children. The midwife shouldn't get drawn into this. She might be accused of incompetence or dishonesty if she mispronounces a pregnancy. And we just get the sense that this is a terribly difficult situation to be in, particularly when the midwife is only aware of what is going on from the outside, obviously. And Louise Bourgeois is quite outspoken about this. Okay. Page 189, you can look at what she has to say there. The midwife has to establish her reputation by performing well in deliveries, but it's also important for her to be able to trust the mother and for the mother to trust her. So we need to get, says Louise Bourgeois, a pact of trust between the midwife and the mother she's serving. And this isn't always easy. So have a look at what Louise Bourgeois has to say about those tensions. Okay. Moving on to the next bullet point then, the position of the midwife in society. What the ascription does rather nicely is to reveal the difficult position in which the professional accredited midwife, such as Louise Bourgeois, found herself at this time in France. She is accredited, she belongs to a midwifery guild, but she is perennially in danger of being associated with superstitious, outmoded and ignorant practice. For instance, Louise Bourgeois warns her daughter against keeping the amniotic membrane which covers the head of some children at birth, because this membrane is highly prized by witches and might therefore associate her with them. She scorns midwives who work with disreputable women and who perform abortions, or who falsely certify a woman as pregnant for money, page 176. And it becomes clear from her text that there are plenty of women practicing midwifery who do not do it in good conscience and who do give the profession a bad name. And it's clearly in her interest to differentiate herself from these. See page 185. So she reveals that she's fully aware that a midwife who isn't careful could easily be grouped with women who are much less professional than she is. She also reveals, thinking about her position in respect of the wider medical world, that she is perennially in danger of being put down by the male medical establishment with their emphasis on medical theory and scientific knowledge. As we've seen, Louise Bourgeois is writing at a time when there was an eagerness for new knowledge in obstetrics and some new anatomical discoveries about pregnancy being made, being documented. So the midwife's oral tradition of passing on essentially practical knowledge was in danger of being overtaken by a thirst for science. And there was, therefore, the beginning of a tendency to respect the male practitioner more than the female, even in childbirth, even in the birthing space that was considered to be traditionally a female domain. So there is a new fashion for male midwives, man midwives. And the name Monsieur Honoré is frequently mentioned. He was obviously an important man midwife in this period. And she wants to just demonstrate her relationship with him, and the fact that she doesn't necessarily need his intervention. So look out for that. Now, Louise Bourgeois scorns the practice of having men routinely in the delivery space as immoral. Virtuous women do not want, and indeed can be grievously harmed by, intimate examination by a man. Their pudor does not permit it, and it can traumatise them. So look out for examples where she raises this point. It's interesting to see just how Louise Bourgeois sees this, the beginnings of an interest in allowing men into the delivery space. Who does she believe is responsible for this? Because she does see it as a kind of sign of moral decline. It has to be said that most women shared Louise Bourgeois' view in this period, and childbirth remained almost an exclusively female domain until towards the end of the 17th century, when instruments were introduced in the delivery room, such as forceps. So Louise Bourgeois is an interesting figure because she's a midwife who has a knowledge of major classical medical texts, who has access to the male medical world up to a point through her husband, but has also learnt her art from women and acquired vast hands-on experience. So Louise Bourgeois then has to position herself between these two groups, the quack, the witch on the one hand, and the doctor on the other. How does she do this? Well, she recognises up to a point her place in the hierarchy. Okay, and the hierarchy was like this. You had trained physicians topping the tree, surgeons underneath, and then practical healers such as teeth pullers in a third rank, and midwives tended to be grouped with that that category of practitioner. So one of the things she does admit, page 187, is that physicians, surgeons or apothecaries, so male practitioners, may need to be called and consulted in an emergency. But outside these conditions, they shouldn't be needed and indeed could do more harm than good. Page 187. Okay. Personnes capables de la charge remédieront fort bien pourvu que l'on les laisse faire. So generally speaking, if you let qualified people, i.e. women, do their job, there shouldn't be a problem if they're allowed to get on with it. Okay. So she's prepared to stand her ground against the potential false superiority of men who actually have little practical experience. But she does also suggest that good midwives work with doctors. For instance, the use of untested remedies will immediately associate a midwife with quacks. But so will also not sharing tried and tested remedies. So what she's worrying about is that midwives are being in danger of being seen as part of a closed circle of women dominating a women's domain. What Louise Bourgeois advocates is looking outward, sharing knowledge and disseminating it more along the lines of men. Okay, page 176. Ne cachez les bons remèdes que vous saurez aux médecins et personnes sages. Okay, so, you know, here she's picking up something of the kind of male field of sharing knowledge, sharing best practice and so on. And we saw that obviously also articulated in the prefaces to the work. Okay, we've already thought a little bit about Louise Bourgeois as a writer, and we've seen how important she regards it in the Récit Véritable to present herself as a kind of active, dynamic practitioner. And she's a very capable writer. She's very capable of staging the drama of delivery and her own importance within that. Okay, if you've not already looked at François Rouget's article, it's worth looking at that. I think it's listed on your first seminar handout and also on the bibliography, just for more details about the way in which Louise Bourgeois writes. Okay. But we need to think about her as being both a quasi-scientific writer, a kind of ethnographic writer in a way. So she's documented aspects of social practice that she sees going on around her, and she comments on this. So she's an observer in a number of different domains, particularly in the instruction. She's also someone who likes to write and who likes to make her texts, I think, readable, perhaps even pleasurable. So look out for her use of metaphor, her use of story to illustrate the point she wants to make. Okay, I think that's it. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see each other next week.